welcome to this special podcast about the traditions Yom Kippur War After 50 Years special edition. My name is Molly Brofsky. I am a teacher at Milchom Abasar Yerushalayim. I also teach for Wurzweiler School of Social Work at Hebrew University, and I am a member of the Tradition Editorial Board. I'm happy to welcome all to this conversation on behalf of Tradition and, of course, of the Rabbinical Council of America, our publishers. I think that when Tradition put out this volume, it kind of expected it to be an interesting retrospective about a very seminal and defining moment in the history of the Jewish people, but I don't think that any of us ever dreamed that that we would be living in a time when the Yom Kippur War would be so relevant and so acutely alive in our life today. I'd also like to mention that the special issue is now available, open access, online. You can download it from the Tradition website. And getting back to what I was saying, I think that all of us in Israel certainly are really, I was just mentioning to Jeff before that, like, we're all feeling like we're all a little bit off balance, dazed, shocked. We're in a moment of, I would be comfortable using the words existential and personal crisis individually and collectively, very similar to the crises of the Six-Day War. What we're going to do, and I'm very much looking forward to these conversations, is talk to three authors of three different pieces from this essay, from this this edition. I will turn to each one individually, introduce them, and talk a little bit with what they wrote, and then have a brief conversation with them. But I also want to mention to all three of you participants that we would be happy to have you all in conversation with each other. I think that would be very, very fruitful and productive. So we're going to start with Dr. Shlomo Fischer. Dr. Fischer, it's a pleasure having the opportunity to speak with you. Dr. Fischer is a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute and professor of sociology emeritus in the School of Education of Hebrew University. Dr. Fischer's piece, which, hold on, I'll open it so I can give you the exact title. I'm sorry. Okay. The Yom Kippur War and the Religious Zionist Community in Israel, which is a pretty clear explanation of what the piece is about. It's basically a sociological analysis of the relationship, I would say the interplay between the Yom Kippur War and the Religious Zionist Community, and how the Religious Zionist Community was impacted by the war and how they in turn impacted on Israeli society and its development. Dr. Fischer also goes through the events leading up to the war. He also talks about very much about the shape of the nation or the country politically, sociologically before the war as well. It's a fascinating piece. I invite everybody to read it. Dr. Fischer, I'm going to open up with the following question. I want to say two things. First of all, Jeff has informed me that you were here. I don't know if you fought in the Yom Kippur War, but that seems to be my impression, that you were here, lived through the Yom Kippur War, and maybe you have. Okay, we've been hacked. Jeff, we've been hacked. What should we do? What do we do? Do we just leave? Do we all leave and reopen?
No, I'll try to kick the person off.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. So if you have any personal reflections to share, I think that would be very insightful for all of us. I think the question is this going to be one person or whether, okay. But to refocus, what I think we all want to know from you is, I think it's pretty obvious to all of us that the parallels to the Yom Kippur War are the catastrophic unpreparedness, military and intelligence failures, or whatever word you want to use there. Mechdal is the word we keep using here in Israel. I think we can use the word failures. Are there any other aspects of similarity, of commonality between the Yom Kippur War and the war that we're fighting today? And if so, could you expand on what you think they are?
Okay, so first of all, some personal hafarot, some personal clarification. I was in Israel from June 1970 to June 1973. In June 1973, I went back to the United States and attended Columbia University. So I was in Manhattan at the time that the war actually occurred. I studied before that in Israel. I studied for 2 years in Karen Yavne. And of the 11, Karen Yavne sustained around 50 casualties, of whom 50 were killed, some of whom from my shiur, and some of whom I knew for us for other reasons. So that's my personal connection. I was not here that war. I participated in the first Lebanese operation much later on when I came back and I met Aliyah and I got married and all kinds of things like that. And I was maguyas to the IDF. So that's just a personal clarification. I think that one of the things that struck me in this past couple of days, and this, I don't mean to, I'm not, I'm doing a sociological analysis. I don't mean to make this sound political, but that in both cases, the official government arms, to a certain extent, stopped functioning. And in both cases, into that vacuum stepped what in Israel is called the Chivra Ezrachit. These past couple of days have been very impressive as far as that's concerned about the ability of the Israeli public, without official direction from the government, without just on the basis of public spiritedness. And I would say, and this is something I talked about in the piece because it has, and I would say, and even to a certain extent, revelations of a general will in the sense of Rousseau, yeah, of the collective good. And I think I think that as I wrote in the article in the 73 war, it had existential, experiential, and theological and ideological implications. I just want to point out that after my article, I wasn't aware of this, after my article was published, Makor Rishon, of course, the religious right-wing newspaper for the moderate one, it's not B'Sheva, which is the less moderate one, published a piece by somebody that I was in yeshiva with 50 years ago, Roni Eisenthal. Hayom, today, Harav Aharon Eisenthal, he's a Ram in Shivat HaGolan, published a very nice piece. And he spoke about, and he wrote about in that piece, I was his brother's roommate in Italy afterward, doesn't matter. So he spoke about in that piece that he talked about 679, talked about Sheshevetesha, which was the Chativa, which was the brigade that was put together as the war started, as they came to the staging areas near the Golan Heights. So 679.
Lomo, you can unmute yourself now.
You're muted.
So Eisenthal spoke about in the article, he spoke about how All right.
Okay, Jeff, do you want to continue?
We're going to continue.
How do you want to handle
this? We're going to lock the meeting so that other people can't get in, and we're kicking out those that are obviously not interested in what we have to say.
Okay, excellent. All right. Wait, Dr. Fisher, you're on mute. Just somebody
comes in and mutes me. All right. So in any event, I was going to say that that he wrote about that the while many of the tank crews themselves were Bnei Shiva, were Banishim, their commanders were kibbutznikim, secular kibbutznikim. Mm-hmm. And that that experience of serving together the kibbutznikim and the Banishim together was a central experience in the war and after the war. And I wrote about in the article how that contributed to the sense on the part of the religious Zionist community that they were, that they were, what they represented and what they wanted to implement was not a sectorial or a sectarian vision, but rather a vision that was shared and that was the general will of the Jewish people. And that was empirically verified. And I think a very similar experience is happening now where I think, by the way, in other words, let me just say this. I think that the experience of the last 8-9 months is still there. It's in the background. I do think it's in the background, and I'm not sure how that will play out. I can think of some bad scenarios, but I think also that the public spiritedness and the coming together and the shared will to overcome this together with or without the government that the Israeli people have shown spans the various sectors in Israeli society and has that element that we had in the Yom Kippur War as well. And it had that element. I just point to one thing about that, and that was that the social media celebrated, I think quite justifiably, the role of Aluf Yair Golan in the first hours and first day of the war, where he single-handedly rescued many, many families in kibbutzim and in yeshuvim. And Aluf Golan, of course, he's a very celebrated army commander, but he was also a rather controversial member of the Knesset on the part of Meretz, and he has very left-wing views. And people pointed out that even the most right-wing Republicans...
I'm sorry. Please continue. If only all of our opponents would merely zoom bomb us, and not the other kind.
It's fine. No problem.
Okay. Yeah.
So what I meant to say is that even the right wing bloggers acknowledged and recognized and celebrated General Golan's very important life saving contribution at the beginning of the war. So that element, I think, is here as well. And I don't know how this is going to play out, but it certainly had in 73 this feeling of the general will and of coming together, not with the of the people coming together, the civic responsibility, I think, played out and had large implications down the road. And this might have large implications down the road as well.
Yeah, I think that's quite fascinating. I have to agree with you. And I would say that I've seen that. I've seen reflections of that. If I'm watching the news and I hear, the broadcaster saying things like, our country can come together. Why in the world can't our politicians come together, even if it's for a national unity government? Or they were interviewing someone who was injured one of his family members was injured, and he said, look how well we're doing as a country. You're supposed to be our leaders, follow our lead. So this, I think people are very, very aware of that feeling today. And I also have seen, as you're saying, examples of like, I forgot exactly what it was, but it was a member, I forgot who was, I think it was maybe a member of the protest movement had shown up to Miluim, and a member of the Chaver Knesset who was very much opposed to him posted the picture and said like, or maybe it was the opposite, maybe whichever way it went, it was like this, like, you know, saluting each other type of thing across the aisle. I very much hope that it does, you know, I guess I would ask you, I don't know if you can have an answer. This is not a question of having a, you know, even though your description is of something almost mystical, right? The way you describe it is like rooted in this idea of like the spirit of the nation that I'll tell you what I'm saying it, this is how I would formulate, I guess, my next question to you, which is the way I read your piece was that the reason that the religious Zionists were kind of motivated to move in the direction that they did after the Yom Kippur War, which is to kind of become more involved. And it was, as you describe in your piece, and as we're talking about now, it was as the hegemony, I would say, let's say, of the labor faction was disappearing. But what the way I read it was that this idea of the spirit of the nation and the will of the people was a belief among the religious Zionists, and that that's what spurred them to make this happen. And now what you're saying about our time is I'm not going to ask you kind of what you're saying about our time, but it's, you're kind of like, you're saying this will is kind of apparent and we're kind of living it. It's not like a conscious decision that we're making to kind of actualize it. It's just that we're seeing it happen.
I think that was the experience they had as well. Experientially, it happened.
Mm-hmm. You're saying it wasn't that they decided, look, Rav Kook is coming true in front of our eyes and we're going to make it happen. It was an experience.
It was an experience that was later reflected upon, and that experience extended itself to the separation of forces agreements and the big demonstrations against Kissinger. Again, by all sectors of Israeli society. That was extremely important. That Moshe Shamir and Naomi Shemer and all these people who are not at all identified with religious Zionism participated in this. So it was something that happened and then was reflected upon and formulated in ideological terms.
Fascinating. So the last thing I'll say, and then I guess we'll, you know, because we only have until, you know, we have an hour and we have two other fascinating people. I could talk to you the whole hour, but just for the one last thing I'll mention is that I think one of the things we saw after the Yom Kippur War was the religious Zionist community became so I don't know what the word would be, enamored or convinced of this national, that they were speaking the words of the people, but in the end, they, you know, the famous sentence, they all ran to the hilltops and they said, you know, acharai, you know, behind me, and they turned around and nobody was there. And I would be very unhappy. I would be hopeful. Let me turn it into a more positive. I would hope that now we can move together with really greater unity. Instead of it, because I think what you're saying is all very true, but unfortunately, I think one of the things most people feel happened after the Yom Kippur War was a greater, maybe I'm wrong, you can tell me, you're the sociologist, a greater kind of I would say separation between the religious Zionists who people found becoming even more and more extreme and the secular population. And I would hope that now we for all kinds of different sociological reasons, there will be a more of a coming together. Would you reflect on any of that?
I think that the religious Zionist sector has been, at least in certain parts of Israeli society, has been tagged as the outlier, as the extremist sector, and because of its representation in the government, and because of the positions taken by those representatives, and they represent a good amount, the majority of their election represents the majority of the religious Zionist public, and nevertheless, I think that. Possibly, I mean, there's a large minority that I think, and that this came out in the last couple of months, I've seen estimates. I mean, there's a large minority of people who do not identify, at least with the judicial reform, and don't identify with that in the religious public. We've seen that. It's a minority, but it's not an insignificant minority.
I agree. I don't think I was even talking more about in the 80s and the 90s. I'm not even talking. I think today the religious Zionist community has become pulled much less towards the, you know, like a kind of a separate entity from the larger population.
So I think that this war and this experience perhaps can strengthen the hands of those people who were more moderate and wanted to see that the religious Zionist community be more connected and less and more connected. Now, I don't know what's going to play out, but it seems that this experience of collective responsibility together, of civic orientation together, will strengthen that position. A lot depends on what's going to play out. A lot depends if there'll be a national unity government and how it will be and how it will function. A lot of stuff is very up in the air. Let's hope
that we seize the moment and are able to channel it in a positive direction. I would would be a small measure of comfort, I think, if that could happen. I'm going to turn now to Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Sinensky, who is the director of the Lamb Heritage Archives and director of Judaic Studies at Mainline Classical Academy in Lower Merion, Pennsylvania. I don't see you, Tzvi, but I assume that when you start talking, you'll show up on my screen. Okay, terrific. So your piece, which again, you can maybe share your title so that I don't have to take everybody's time by, kind of like looking for it.
I think it was Rabbi Lamb's.
Here it is.
Lamb's resilient response to the Yom Kippur War.
Exactly.
Did I get
Lamb's
it right?
Resilient response. You got it perfect. You got your own title perfect. Rabbi Lamb's resilient response to the Yom Kippur War, in which you basically outline six messages. You mentioned that Rabbi Lamb had visited Israel in 1973, and you outline six messages that you pull from his sermons and his writings that you think were responses to the events of the time and messages that he was kind of bringing to the American Jewish community. You are here of the four of us as the American. You are American representative, and as such, I think it's very kind of interesting and important and useful for us to hear your view from there. We're all very, very much kind of ensconced, mired, almost drowning in our view from here. And I think it's important for us to also have a kind of perspective of how rabbinic and educational leadership in America, how you're processing this and what you think you guys can help us, how you can contribute. So I guess the question I would ask you in terms of your article is, if you want, you can briefly talk a little bit about what you wrote in your piece about the wisdom that Rabbi Lamb brought to the American Jewish community at the time. But from your particularly uniquely American vantage point, what messages do you think, perhaps messages in the article, perhaps other messages, because you're very much a scholar of Rabbi Lamb's corpus. What messages do you think? I mean, it's very early, but nonetheless, I think the crisis is acute and we all feel this, we feel the crisis. Do you have any idea what messages Rabbi Lamb, we can glean from Rabbi Lamb's writings for this particular crisis, particularly in light of maybe its parallels to the crisis of the Yom Kippur War?
Yeah, absolutely. And you hit it on the head that there's no time. I'll get to this a little bit later, but there's nothing like being in Israel at a moment like this. As much as we in America would like to say we're experiencing the real thing, it's really just a mere shadow or approximation of those who are at the forefront of Jewish history and Jewish destiny at the most difficult and painful and tragic of moments. Who nonetheless somehow managed to summon such strength and, as Rabbi Lamb said, resilience. So it's an inspiration to be here with you and so many more who are in Israel. In terms of, this picks up both on your question, Rabbi Lamb's experience in writings, as well as Dr. Fisher, some of your comments. One of the things I think is most amazing, even setting aside Rabbi Lamb for just a moment, has just been to see the parallel level of, on the one hand, frankly, trauma, of pain, of suffering, not in the same way as those who are on the front lines, but nonetheless, this Simchas Torah, for us, it was 31 hours after it concluded for brethren in Israel, And it was just, you know, similar to many of the descriptions that Rabbi Lem himself and so many others spoke about in terms of that Yuri Yom Kippur 50 years ago, almost exactly to the day on the Gregorian calendar. I have to say it was just surreal. At the same time, from the moment that the events happened and right now, I have to say I was in a WhatsApp group with some colleagues today. And one of them was sharing, and I think it represents all of our sentiments, the level of mobilization right now among U.S. Jewry feels like nothing I've experienced in my lifetime. And during the Intifada and at other moments, there were moments when we really felt like we were coming together, despite the increase in polarization that we've all experienced in Israel, America, you know, across the Western world over the last number of decades. But there's something different now, whether it be the rallies, whether it be the donations that are pouring in, whether it be buying tickets for soldiers to get back to Israel as soon as possible. As someone who's working right now, I just saw to get 500 Miluimniks from Peru. I didn't even know there are 500 Miluimniks in South America to get them over to Israel.
If you were Israeli, you would know that there are a lot more Israelis in South America than 500.
So I guess, yeah. Right, that's fair. That is very fair. But I guess in Peru, in my defense. But the limitation of the view, nonetheless, yeah. Yes. good. It's not only India these days, yeah.
Exactly.
But the it's been really just incredibly inspiring at the same time. So there's a way in which there's an experience here, and at a very divided moment as well for United States Jewry, of course, in our own way, which are more reflective, I would say, of the general political polarizations that we find in the United States, and American Jewry is very, even modern Orthodoxy itself is very much split sharply along those lines, depending on a variety of different factors and all of that. So, we're also asking this question after a period of such extreme polarization in our general community, which is reflective of the general polarization. And I think it was Michael Goodman who recently said something effective that one could argue that polarization is just another way of saying hate, which we could debate, but we go back and forth. But the point is, it's polarization is doesn't describe the emotional aspect of what we're going through. And I think that there's certainly that as well. So that's just something that certainly Rabbi Lem emphasized. And so it's extremely important. And there's cross-denominational collaboration while at the same time recognizing the fundamental and even, unbridgeable chasms ideologically between the denominations, but that we could sit on the same synagogue councils while having respectful, firm disagreements. And he spoke about this extensively, right? Unity without uniformity, all of these kinds of things. This was central to his platform, his vision of modern Orthodoxy, centrist Orthodoxy at various points in his career. So that, I think, is just one thing we're experiencing on the ground, which is very much consistent with what you were just describing. And I think we're asking ourselves a lot of the same questions, whither from here, right? In other words, is this just going to be an ephemeral moment? I think, Rabbi Lem, I think coming back to your discussion also about Ruth Cook, I think is really interesting. I think Rabbi Lem and Anglo religious Zionism has perhaps something humbly to offer here, which is a sense of kind of a realistic, non-kind of mystical overlay to reality, which of course is very Cookian. But when we think about Rabbi Lam's Zionism, and it was expressed particularly with regards to the Yom Kippur War, yes, it was aspirational. Yes, it was meant to be, to strive for something more, but it was always grounded in a very, very sober sense of reality, and never trying to imagine that someone is different than they are, but rather that we are who we are, and that it's patronizing, quite frankly, to assume things of our non-religious brethren. If, in Tel Aviv right now, there are non-kosher kitchens where they are preparing food for Chayalim, it's not because they're on their way to, it's not messianic. It's not because tomorrow they're going to keep kosher. It's because right now there's a sense of unity. There's a sense that there's something bigger that we're fighting for, and that, as Dr. Fisher said, it's up to us to determine moving forward whether or not we carry that forward unity, and you know, whether we continue to splinter, it gets better, it gets worse, it's just more of the same. That's up to us. And that's a very non-Cookian, that's a very kind of sober perspective.
Yeah. Can I, Molly, would you mind if I jumped in with a question here?
I wanted to make a comment on what's be said, but go ahead.
So I'll just switching hats as one of the authors to the editor of the issue. That's Svi, of course, your piece looked at a number of sermons. Rabbi Lam, you know, was the self-styled unrepentant darshan. He was the unparalleled darshan speaker, public speaker in his day from his pulpit at the Jewish Center in that time in the early 70s. And as in your role as the director of the Lam Heritage Archive, which catalogs and archives all of his many drashot, both recorded material and written material. So you did a deep dive into his drashot and his speeches and sermons around the Yom Kippur War, both as form and content. In other words, the drasha, the sermon as a piece of a teaching platform, as well as the content of what he was saying. So in 4 days from now, every rabbi in North America, every rabbi around the world is going to have to stand up in his pulpit and speak to this issue. You know, this never happens. This never happens that every sermon in the world, in every synagogue, Reform, conservative, orthodox, right, left, center, everyone's going to have to be addressing this. It's the only possible thing. If somebody's going to get up and talk about the Nachash and Gan Eden and something else, he should be removed immediately. So if somebody wants to look at Rabbi Lam's sermons as a kind of template, as a kind of model for how to go about doing this, about what notes to hit, what messages to hit, with, yes, mind you, it's 50 years later, what is that person going to come away with? What insights is that sermonizer who has to prepare going to come away with by looking to Rabbi Lam as a model or a guide for what should be done this coming Shabbat?
Absolutely, and it's a very powerful question. A little humbling. I should just acknowledge as well that present here is the executive director of the Rabbinical Council of America, Rabbi Mark Dratch, who's a greater expert than I in so many respects, both in terms of his knowledge of Rabbi Lam's drashot, but also having been his chavruta and as a son-in-law, and working through some of these ideas.
Yes. Rabbi Dratch, you know how to work the unmute button if you'd like to join in the conversation here.
Thank you. I'm just getting nachas from my nephew-in-law.
That's his way of saying that everything I know he knows double and is restraining himself very kindly. Jeff, I'll say the following. First of all, I received a number of messages from this past Shabbat, actually. Literally, there's one rabbi in Woodmere who walked into his shul, apparently, and that's someone forwarded me this message. It happened to be that someone was on the Lam Archives list and so had printed out. It happens to be that I decided at the last moment, even though I had another one in mind, they said, how could I not resend the sermon that Rabbi Lam gave on Shmini Atzeret right before Simchat Torah in 1973? How can we be happy on this Simchat Torah? You know, that has to be the drasha for this week. So usually I make a policy, I really try not to resend anything except for the summertime drasha. He was only present for a couple of years. Most of the summers in his career, he was able to get off. He was a camp rabbi in Camp Russia for many years. But this one, I just had to repeat. And this happened in multiple shuls, but just to give one example, a layperson walked in, he showed his rats, and then the news started getting out on Shabbos morning in shul, and he handed it to his rabbi. Rabbi scrapped his drasha and read a segment of Rabbi Lam's drasha, and then added a couple of extra reflections, and that was his drasha. This past Shabbos, on the fly, he scrapped everything that he had. It was like Shir of the Rav or something like that. He just threw out the papers and had to start again. And so you're right, they really do speak to the moment. What are some of those messages? You know, one of the messages of that not that Shabbat, but you know, almost immediately afterward, while the fighting was still underway, he delivered on Sukkot in 1973. It was entitled "Peace in Pieces," yeah. And he really went through both with regard to physical peace between us and our enemies, as well as with regard to peace internally in terms of unity, as well as in terms of even religious achievements. This notion that life is not all or nothing. And he had this exquisite comment that he cited in the name of Rav Kook, notwithstanding my comments earlier. Certainly he was a master darshan and drew very, very broadly from such great thinkers. And Rav Kook asked the question at one point, why is it that we refer to MS, to truth, as Chotamo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the seal of God? Whereas when it comes to peace, to Shalom, we say that it's the shame. Shalom is one of the names of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's perhaps qualifies as a kinui. What's the difference? And Rav Kook answered, said Rabbi Lam, that when it comes to MS, it's all or nothing. And either Moshe or Aaron, it's Yikov Hadin Sahar. It's going to be, it's either truth or it's falsehood. And there's very little in between. And so that's a seal. Right? You impress the seal. And so it either is the command of the king or it's not. Either it's something that we all must follow or it's not law at all. Whereas when it comes to peace, it's really, it's like writing something. If you, instead of inscribing a seal, you write a name. So actually one, you can have one letter without the other letter. You write, it can be partially writing out the word Shalom or any other word. That writing can be partial, like the Gemara talks about Shem Shimon. Yes, it can be a complete word, but it's not the full word, all these kinds of things. And so he said, there can be peace in pieces. And I think it's an incredibly powerful, not the only message, but one of the messages I think is incredibly powerful is we live in a world today where everything is about MS in the sense that, actually, I think it's not about MS necessarily, but it's presented as if it's about
my MS. Yeah.
Right. This is the MS. There is no Milchamta Shel Torah. There are no two sides. This is the only truth, and there is no partial truth either. There is no, you know, there is no unity that is meaningful in its own right. No one is going to rejoice at everything that's happening this coming Shabbat, barring a remarkable miracle. That's not what we anticipate. That's not what we anticipate seeing. But at the same time, we can hold tragedy, hold loss, hold sacrifice, hold agony, incomprehensible agony on the one hand, and beautiful, inspiring stories, individual stories of soldiers, of civilians helping pack up the soldiers in American Jewry, of us mobilizing like we have not seen perhaps in our lifetime, of religious stirrings that people have accepted new commitments in their own religious lives just in the last couple of days alone, and that we can hold both of these together. This is the moment to say there can be peace in pieces.
Beautiful. That's really beautiful. First of all, I want to say thank you very much for everything you've said. I hadn't thought about, you know, the splitting of the American Jewish community in the same way. Like that was something I wasn't as aware of coming from here, that there's that really that sense of I know that there are polarizations between different factions, but like that the fault line of the political fault lines actually splitting the modern Orthodox community as being so kind of present, I think is very important for us to hear, because you know we don't always understand American Jewry the same way. You know, like I think it's important to have this dialogue between Israeli Jewry and American Jewry, and I think that what you're saying is so valuable about being able to hold multiple truths on so many levels. I think in terms of the polarization, this ability to be aware that it's not as you wrote in your article, it's not a zero sum game. You know, it's not all or nothing, and that. My truth doesn't have to negate your truth. I don't know if we have time for this, but I would be interested in hearing Dr. Fisher's take on whether I think there's been a lot of labeling the religious Zionist community as messianists in a way that I don't think is fully fair. To the credit of, I think, is again, back to the, it's like all the same sociology. People who did that after which the stuff that all seems so trivial now and nonsensical, that the Dizengoff Yom Kippur incident, politicians who came out and said, these are radical messianists, had to kind of walk back their statement and say, oops, I didn't mean that, you know? I think it's like both truths are true. Like one is that each side, and again, I, to be fair, because I'm, you know, a religious Zionist, so I'm kind of defending my camp and saying, no, we're not such radical messianists. I've also seen things like, you know, a story of a young woman who fought like a lion, like a lioness, I suppose, and saved an entire community. And then like the last line was, and yes, she is one of the leftist protesters in Kaplan, right? Who everybody kind of puts a label on as like, you know, an anti-Zionist. And so that this ability for both sides to see the piece in pieces is so important. And again, I just, if only we could hold on to that. And I guess what you're saying, which is I think valuable, is we did have, because I think we're all feeling this lack of leadership. Certainly in the political realm, I'm not sure it's true in the religious realm, but well, I guess the way I would say it then is somebody has to step up, and maybe our rabbinic leaders can step up and kind of bridge those gaps. And I think a lot of what Rabbi Len had to say very much, I think, speaks to this moment. And I think it's very important, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you sharing those pieces, because again, it all comes together. It seems that this is the motif of the time, which is, can we learn these lessons? And again, even if our official leadership is failing us, can other people fill that space? It makes me think of Sefer Shoftim, right? Where the leaders are just not doing their job, but then finally, you know, you get Shmuel and you get to, you know, eventually Beit David, or you get to Ruth, who comes out of the sidelines, and people do step up. And eventually we do come to a better place. So halavai if only. Okay, Jeff, I think it's time to turn to you and your extremely moving piece. So Jeff Sachs is, one second, I just have to get your bio. Excuse me.
I'm the editor of tradition.
The editor of tradition, our exactly. Yes, and the founding director of Atid and Web Yeshiva. Jeff is also coming to us from his mamad, which I think very much speaks to the time that we're living in. Also, I don't know if any of you noticed, but I like got up and left in the middle of Dr. Fisher's speech. That was because somebody was ringing my bell incessantly. And in these days, you cannot ignore a ringing doorbell, because I don't know, maybe it was the Rav Shatz, you know, the head of the army coming to tell us all to close our doors and windows, which is why I had to kind of, you know, mute myself, disappear, and go check on the door. So, you know, sign of the times. Jeff, your piece, I have to say, I found extremely moving. You translated a piece of Rav Shagar, Rav Sabatos. See, it shows you how spacey I am. You know, I can't even keep my people straight. That Rav Sabato had written a book called Tiyum Kavanot, Adjusting Sites. And he wrote recently a piece reflecting on his own work, which has been translated and is published in Tradition. And then Jeff's piece is a reflection of Chaim Sabato's of a moment in Chaim Sabato's book, which is also reflected upon in this piece that was published for Tradition, that was translated. And it's the moment where Rav Sabato, in the middle of the 1973 war, well, there are two parallel moments, I would say. One is an actual moment. It's the moment when he feels that he is either going to live and die, and he feels the presence of God, and he feels that God is saving him. And he has a religious / spiritual experience that is so profound that he's almost, he says, I never want to forget this again, but that it's so profound that he was almost, he says in his reflective piece that he didn't write it in his book because it was almost too surreal and too powerful.
And that he feared that people wouldn't actually believe it.
Right. It was just beyond belief, but it was such an intensely for him, maybe one of the definitive moments of his life. And at the same time, Rav Sabato's book very much deals with the question of doubt. Faith and doubt, if we're talking about Rabbi Lam and faith and doubt, right? So, but the doubt piece, I was saved, but what about my best friend who was not? And, you know, I had this moment of clarity, but you know what? We both got a bracha from the Rebbe. You know, he talks about how he met this Hasidish Rebbe on his way out to war, and they both got this bracha that they would be saved, and only one of them came back. And he also, I found particularly fascinating, Rav Shagar plays a role. That's why I think Rav Shagar came out of my mouth before. Rav Shagar, who's I think taking a lot of the modern zeitgeist by storm with his focus on doubt and learning how to live in doubt. And so that side of things, right? This like unquestionable pure faith, you call it, I think, point blank, you can remind me, but point blank prayer.
Point blank prayer, yeah.
Well, exactly.
That plays off the double entendre of the title
I guess we should mention
for those that may not know, Rav Chaim Sabato is the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hesder Yeshiva in Ma'ale Adumim, Birkat Moshe, which he founded and has headed for many years together with Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. And at a certain point, he became a rather celebrated Hebrew novelist, modern novelist. Now, his novels are almost always autobiographically informed. They're memoiristic pieces. And when you speak to him about this, he refuses to engage in questions of, is this autobiography? Is this fiction? He will not engage on that question. But Tiyum Kavanot, his most well-known, most important book, one of the most important works of modern Hebrew literature in our lifetime, is the most authentic depiction of the Yom Kippur War. And partially because, I mean, beyond the fact that he's just such a moving and beautiful, beautiful writer, I'll come back to that point. Let me put an asterisk in the conversation here. I want to come back to that in a moment. But because, you know, for us and all of our listeners, and I think all of the authors in this special issue that we did, we weren't exploring today, right now, there are a lot of questions. I mean, nobody has answers, but there are a lot of questions. And there'll be a commission and there'll be an investigation and blame will be placed here or there and governments will rise or fall because of that. But our bigger questions aren't you know, how this mechdal happened, the blunder, the term that was used, you know, in 1973, and, you know, which is of course being dusted off and reused now, but questions of the theological thorn,
exactly. Right?
These are questions not
that's
pointed
what
at
I want to hear from
they're
you.
Pointed. They're pointed at Shemaim, and
exactly.
that's the greatness, that's the power of adjusting sites of Tiyum Kavanot.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's no reference, to his higher commanders, anyone above who was with him in the tank, let alone pointing fingers at Golda Meir and at
absolutely. It's not about politics, and it's not even
about the military, right? It's about how he wrestles with this, and that's
it's about the human
play.
Experience.
That's the play, because he's a young Bachur. Has there, and he's there on Yom Kippur. They get the call. They go off on a Motzei Yom Kippur. They're whisked off to the tanks. You know, the unsupplied, unready tanks on the Golan, and tanks with unadjusted sights. It's not important to go into the technicalities of what it means to adjust the sight of a tank, but basically, unless the periscope is aligned, you can't fire. You're just firing blind, because the gunner sits in the belly of the tank, and there's a beautiful evocative passage where he's there in the belly of the tank like Yonah. I mean, this is a book about Yom Kippur, like Yonah in the belly of the ship, and like the sailors above telling Yonah to pray to Davin, his commander, who's not a religious fellow, says to him, Sabato, Titpaleo, Yorim, they're firing on us, Davin. And he prays, and he says he prayed with there wasn't a hair's breadth between my heart and my lips. But until then, he's been struggling. I mean, first of all, it's very difficult to keep a careful prayer regimen when you're busy in a tank fighting a war. But even when he had a moment that he could steal away to say a quick mincha, it was hopeless. Because how can you have kavana when you're thinking about your friend Dov, who's gone missing and is presumed dead? And then suddenly in that moment on the tank, as the tank is on fire and they're jumping out of it to save their lives. And in the next tank, Shagar, this is autobiographically true. Shagar was in the next tank, right? Mm-hmm. And he's his life is saved, but he's severely, severely wounded and burned and scarred, mm-hmm. but damage mm-hmm. that stayed with him for the rest of his life. And, you know, he died tragically young. And he said, but in that moment, I knew the secret of prayer. Because there was ti'um kavanot. That's what I call in the title, point blank prayer.
Point blank.
Because mm-hmm. what does it mean to shoot someone point blank? You don't need to aim when the gun is right up against your target. What does it mean to pray when you're right there in the palace of the king? Right? When you feel that God's hand is on you, you don't need kavana. Kavana is when we pray and we have to send the prayer at some distance. You know, like if you don't put the zip code on the letter, there's no chance it'll get there. But here, you're handing it directly. You're in God's hand. Kavana is almost mutar. It's almost redundant.
And
that's the power of a book, to take something like this, to take an experience like this. So when I wrote the piece, this is a piece that I spent a long time writing. I started writing it actually years ago. And then, like so many things, it sat in the computer. And then when we came up with this idea to do this special issue, I took it out and reworked it. And I had the opportunity actually to speak to him about it a little bit. And I mentioned that in one of the footnotes in the piece. And then this idea came up that we would translate an untranslated piece, which is not memoir, which is not fiction. This is an actual memoiristic piece that he writes about the reception history of the book, Adjusting Sights, was published 25 years ago, meaning the halfway point between the events it describes and our day. And you know, when I went back to it, so you know, the nature of these things is, you know, I worked on this essay and on all of the other essays in the volume, you know, probably about 6 months ago, when Yom Kippur seemed far off and no one could imagine that we'd be in the situation that we're in. So sometimes when, you know, you publish a piece, you haven't really read it yourself in quite a while. And if you're lucky, other people are responding to it. And Zvi, like you said, I had a similar experience. Many people with this particular issue, many rabbis and shuls and other people use the material from this issue in their sermons on Yom Kippur. Also not knowing how timely it would tragically become. But let me just end with this. So this afternoon, in advance of our conversation, I sat down to reread not only what I wrote, but, you know, to reread the passage from Rav Shagar, and tears were streaming down my cheeks. Now, this is a piece that I translated myself. I know it quite well, but it means something completely different today than it did 72 or 80 hours ago.
That's what spoke to me so profoundly was, again, like what you're describing. When I read your piece, when I got to the piece, you know, the piece of the point blank range prayer, it spoke to me very, very profoundly as a something to hold on to, a hope in that connection to God. And then, which is part of the book, and I think also feeds into our conversation, the complexity of, as you said, not only before that did he had difficulty having kavanah, but then he knows in the moment, he knows he's going to go back to real life and he's going to lose that direct line to God. And he knows that the questions of doubt are going to creep in, and he knows that he's going to live the rest of his life trying to balance those two things and to hold them. And it reminds me very much of what she was saying before about the piece in pieces, which is hold both of them. They don't have to contradict. But that's very difficult to do. So I guess my question to you, I have a double question. Also, when we spoke a little bit before, we spoke a little bit also about the power of literature, which I think to me was also very moving, that idea that, like, the things that last for us, the way we remember our history, is always in stories, right? That storytelling is the way in which human beings pass down the wisdom, their learned wisdom, their collective consciousness, and often their history. It's always in stories. That's what stories are meant to do. That's why we tell stories. Mamash, right? Though that's what Tanakh is. It's all stories, right? The history of humanity is told in stories. It can be Vigata Televincha, and it can be fairy tales that we tell our children. And so literature is such a powerful, not only window into the experience of the time, but it can also live, you know, again, Vigata Levincha, it can live as a paradigm for how to transmit the messages that we want to hold on to. And so to me, like the idea of Rav Sabato's book as holding some of these timely and timeless messages was extremely powerful. And so I'll turn to you the question that we kind of asked Tzvi, which was, you know, what do you think of, like, you know, do you have anything to say about that idea of the literary aspect of it? Because I know that's one of your fields. You know, also, what messages do you think we can take? What can we hold on to help us through this time? Yeah. That would be what I'd be interested in hearing.
Well, you know, I opened the piece with a reference to something that of Aaron Lichtenstein, you know, who of course spoke to this issue, the power of literature and literature's potential to help us grow as thinking religious beings, a phrase that our friend and teacher Shalom Karmi often uses. And so Rav Aaron says that great writers are preeminent among those who have at least attained and revealed some measure of knowledge. Imaginative artists have been more illuminating than theoreticians, not only because they've described more powerfully, but because they have also probed more deeply. The author melds precision and sensitivity, intuition and acuity to perceive and portray concrete personal and social reality, you know, in ways sometimes more than theologians and philosophers and historians. Now, of course, we're not throwing out those shelves of our books as well.
I want to also say that it reminds me of Dr. Fisher's collective unconscious sort of idea, mm-hmm. you know, that Cookian idea that right. you know, we're plugging into the literature that lasts is the literature that, right. that plugs into that.
Right. Yeah. Now, it's impossible for us to know. It's impossible as we struggle for questions, you know, both the lofty and the political, practical. You know, it's maybe even more impossible for us to know what works of art and literature. You know, in the issue, there's I think a lovely piece about Naomi Shemer's music and how that was a response to the Yom Kippur War. You know, what will hopefully come out of this? Hopefully, it will end soon. Hopefully, the death tally stops right now. We don't add even one more single soul to that count, but it is what it is. And it's traumatic and it's tragic and it's unprecedented. But in a generation from now, what will we look at? What will be contributed, you know, artistically to help us remember to be the bearer of those messages? In the essay, I spend some time, because of my interests and some other hats that I wear, dealing with this incessant comparison between Sabato and Shai Agnon, which is, I'm mm-hmm. sure many listeners know, is an interest of mine. I think, you know, despite my affinity to Agnon, I think it's an overstated comparison, as does, by the way, Sabato, or at least it's a misplaced comparison. People misunderstand in what ways Sabato is
Agnon. What you write about in your essay.
You can read, you can read the essay to see what I say about that, but in one way they are similar. Because Agnon was trying to capture something about a world that was lost through fiction, through literature, in ways that were more true, more deeply true than works of history.
Correct.
I expand on that in the piece. You can read it there. We don't need to go into it now. But sometimes, you know, truth is greater than the history with a capital H.
Absolutely.
Academic.
Which again, I think goes back to Dr. Fisher's piece as well. That the truth is expressed in the, I don't know. That was the answer that was given to my question of, like, you know, was this conscious or unconscious? And no, it's unconscious. It just kind of happens.
If I can respond to that.
Yeah.
It's not, in Rav Kook, it's not unconscious, it's metaphysical. In other words, Knesset Yisrael is a metaphysical concept. And when it's revealed here, it's an emanation from Knesset Yisrael, which is the last sphera in Kabbalah and translates supernal reality into mundane reality. And that's a metaphysical concept. And that is what's revealed when the general will is revealed. So it's a different language game.
For sure.
It's not unconscious, which is, let's say, you know, the collective unconscious or Freudian type concept.
Yeah.
Jungian type concept. But it rather,
it's a metaphysical concept.
Yeah.
Although Rav Kook also says that the job of the artist is to reveal the whatever you want to call them, the existential divine truths of reality, which is kind of, Jeff, what you're talking about. Okay. It's quite fascinating. Jeff, would you, go ahead, Svi, please.
I know we're late on time and people probably have.
We're gonna end
Very quickly, one thing that strikes me is that, you know, who will be the poets of the coming generation? It's very interesting in this moment when the Yishai Ribos of the world, right, are kind of the public cultural representatives in some ways, or spiritual. What would happen in a world in which, and I think this is quite realistic, is at least a possibility, a Yishai Ribo Udiime will become the bearer of also a profound cultural and even, you know, kind of, you know, be that composer, the next Nomi Shemer, coming from the Dati Lumi or whatever community, or even not only Dati Lumi community, but kind of like this cross-section that defies easy categorization, which I think is maybe a better way of thinking about his contributions and his persona, and what would that mean for that to be the next hero poet of, that's, you know,
beautiful. And there are many of those here.
Yeah,
I think it's a beautiful, you're right, and the way Yishai Ribo also, like, that's a beautiful example of the way he impacted American society when he gave his concert and how much it resonated. I think he's a perfect example of what you're talking about. So I think that's a great point. Thank you. Okay, Jeff, I think, will you kind of close us up by reading from your piece?
Well, I'll read from Rav Sabato's piece.
Exactly.
Right. This is a piece that appears in Hebrew in his volume, his untranslated volume, B'Shafrir Chevyon. This is the closing chapter of that book, which appears in Tradition. And again, the whole issue is available as a downloadable, a digital book from traditiononline.org. But it's a passage where he relates a story that 5 years after he wrote Tum Kavanot, there was a memorial event for one of their comrades who had fallen in 73. And he was invited to be on this panel together with Rav Shagar and others. And there was a moderator that was kind of talking to them about their experiences, but the moderator himself was not someone who had been in the war. Maybe he was younger or I don't know what. And there's this kind of distance because, you know, like he is a kind of, say, Sabato conveys the sense that, you know, if you were there, you know, and if you weren't there, there's no way for us to explain it to you. And they're talking about these questions of faith and doubt and trauma, faith shattered and restored. And the moderator asks Sabato, what of the pain, the fear, the burnt tanks around you, your good friends? What did it all do to your faith, to your emunah? And this is the passage. It appears on page 38 in the chapter. I answer him. Every moment, my faith grew stronger. I can't explain to you why. Maybe because I saw with my own eyes what a person's life is, and I stood alone in front of my Creator. Perhaps from the power of a pure, simple prayer. Everything I learned all my life, everything I read and heard in yeshiva concerned emunah pshuta, simple faith. These feelings of the heart burned in me so much to an extent that I remember saying to myself then, I know the day will come when the heart will be numb. I know days will come when I will have forgotten everything. Such is the way of the world. New things sweep out the old. Heartbreak gives way in the face of routine. And who knows what my faith will be then? Therefore, I said to myself during the war, I will write on a note what is inscribed in my heart. And every time I weaken in my faith, I will look at it and remember. I always had a small notebook in my shirt pocket. It had become greased with machine gun oil, but it was the most precious thing to me. In it, I wrote poems. I remember one poem. in prayer shoals enfolded with palm fronds in hand, their shelters imploded, no barriers withstand, earthly refuge corroded, in heaven's shadow they stand. And as in the Hebrew, the imagery of the sukkah collapsing, the lulav in hand, but ultimately they're not saved, but sila de mehmuta, the protection of the sukkah, they're protected only directly by God's hand. I tore the page from the notebook and wrote down my feelings and thoughts, and I also wrote there, when the day comes and I forget, I will read this note. I placed the note on the periscope in front of me in the tank, where the gunners would tape what was truly valuable to them. Some fellows put their wives' photos, others put their little boys' letters. I put the notebook with this page there. I placed it before my eyes always. Shviti lenegdi tamid. A few days later, the tank was washed at the base encampment with a high-pressure hose. The notebook was also washed out of this world. I remembered a parable of the Chassidim. To what can this be compared? To those who were walking in the forest on a dark and gloomy night, and their way was lost in a stormy tempest, and they knew not where to turn. Suddenly, lightning flashed. Many looked to the sky in awe of the lightning's beauty illuminating the fog. The lightning passed, and they remained wrapped in the fog. But there were those who looked into the thicket of the forest to find the path forward by the illumination of the lightning bolt.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think that's a perfect place to end. Thank you. Thank you to Jeffrey Sachs. Thank you to Shlomo Fisher. Thank you to Tzvi Sinensky. I hope that we in any way gave people something to hold on to, something to illuminate the path forward. The edition is available for downloading on the Tradition website. And may we all see peaceful times, and may there be safety and peace for our soldiers, for our civilians, for our country, and for all Jews all over the world. Thank you very much.